Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today I'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the escalation of tension in the Strait of Hormuz and the Gulf of Oman following the shootdown of a $100 million American Reaper drone by the Iranians, which has President Trump saying, quote, "Iran made a very big mistake," then backtracking furiously to caution, "I find it hard to believe it was intentional." Clearly, our art of the deal president does not want a war with Iran, which we hope does not happen. But he is also signaling to the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps that they can get away with taunting the great Satan. A specialist on U.S.-Iran relations, Hussein Banai, an Iranian-American scholar and professor of international studies at Indiana University and author of the forthcoming book Hidden Liberalism in Modern Iran, joins us to discuss the incoherence of Trump's foreign policy in handling a burgeoning crisis of his own making, which is the result of his obsession with tearing up anything Obama achieved. Furthermore, there is a deadly symbiosis between the hawks on our side and on theirs, made much more dangerous by the messianic religious subtext of the Supreme Leader's apocalyptic belief in their Messiah, the hidden Imam, returning, and the equally incendiary spiritual pornography of so-called Christians invested in the end times and Armageddon, who, like Secretary of State Pompeo, believe in the rapture. Then, with the feckless display of a lack of strategy on the part of the Democrats, who held a closed-door hearing with Hope Hicks, at which the White House lawyer prevented her from saying anything, which, had it been televised, would have at least shown the extent of obstruction by the White House, but instead showed a bunch of hand-wringing from frustrated Democratic members of Congress, we will speak with Mike Lux, the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies, the author of How to Democrat in an Age of Trump. He joins us to discuss how focus groups have shown that once average Americans learn what is actually in the Mueller report, they want to impeach Trump. Then finally, we'll look into the need for a revival of the journalism of I.F. Stone in the age of Trump and speak with Peter Dreyer, professor of politics at Occidental College and the author of The 100 Greatest Americans, a Social Justice Hall of Fame, who has an article at Common Dreams in praise of I.F. Izzy Stone. With an onslaught of corruption and the looting of our government underway by Trump and his cronies, the need for an indefatigable researcher and an uncompromising critic of political oligarchy, crony capitalism, racism, and American militarism could not be more critical today. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Hussein Banai, who's an Iranian-American scholar and professor of international studies at Indiana University in Bloomington, where he teaches Iran's political development as well as U.S.-Iran relationships. And his forthcoming book is Hidden Liberalism in Modern Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Hussein Banai.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us. And it would seem that things are escalating in the Gulf, particularly in the Gulf of Oman and the Straits of Hormuz, and with the shootdown of an American drone, a fairly expensive, over $100 million pilotless plane, the Global Hawk, as it's called. The president is sending mixed signals. He's saying, on the one hand, that Iran made a big mistake, but on the other hand, he's basically saying, well, I don't really think it was on purpose. That wasn't he was sort of letting the leadership off the hook by suggesting that they didn't really do it, that somebody further down the chain of command did it, which is highly unlikely. So just to begin with, even though I'm sure you don't want a war in the Gulf, and I don't want a war in the Gulf, and most Americans don't want a war in the Gulf, and the president himself said, look, in interview when he's hosting the Canadian Prime Minister in the White House, he said, look, I said I want to get out of these endless wars. I campaigned on that. So just in practical terms, in terms of having a commander-in-chief who's competent, this president is just so unbelievably incompetent. I mean, he's signaling to the Iranians that they pretty much get away with anything. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. I think, you know, when he was campaigning to become president, there was this narrative about Trump as someone who kind of talked big but really didn't have any practical understanding of the basic machinery of the U.S. government, let alone of how other governments might work. And I think we are now seeing the effects of that kind of on a daily basis in real time in fairly distressing and depressing ways. And in the case of Iran, I think you have someone who very clearly is has had an impulse about the relationship with Iran that had more to do with his predecessor, meaning that he wanted to really just end the Iran deal and kind of stick his finger one more time in Barack Obama's foreign policy legacy, get the bragging rights for that, but really never considered the price or what the day after might look like. And, of course, this was always going to be ripe for exploitation for people who had other designs and plans to really, you know, undertake regime change or isolate Iran once again in international community, people like his national security advisor, John Bolton, or his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. And so you have this kind of spectacular incompetence would really be too generous a term. You have this kind of spectacular clash of multiple depravities that the rest of us have to live with on a day-to-day basis.
Well, clearly you can see how by pulling out of the JCPOA, the P5+1 deal, that sort of set us on a collision course with Iran. The whole purpose of the JCPOA, you know, nobody said it was going to fix everything in terms of this fraught relationship with Iran, but at least it was going to sort of contain the more radical elements in Iran. And you know, by reneging on it, he sort of unleashed those radical elements, surely, in Iran, and we're seeing the consequences. I mean, the plane or the drone was operating clearly in international waters, and the U.S. has proof that that was the case. But, you know, Iran operates on asymmetrical warfare principles, don't they? In other words, their deterrence against an attack from Israel is Hezbollah. And their right. deterrence for an attack against their homeland by the United States is the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps. And they're the guys that are pinpricking and taunting the United States as we speak.
Right. And not to mention that they've had 16 years of practice in Iraq and in the wider Middle East since the Iraq War. Of doing this sort of tit-for-tat, these kind of micromanaged battles with American and multinational forces. So they're fairly seasoned when it comes to this kind of, type of warfare. But I think you're absolutely right, going back to your larger point about JCPOA being the trigger, or the United States leaving from JCPOA being a major trigger behind the latest round of crisis. I think this is a point that has to be kind of talked about more publicly. And frankly, I think the Democrats and the opposition has to underline more. The JCPOA was not just this a kind of a flash in the pan, you know, very tough arms control deal that basically forced the United States to acknowledge Iran's you know, national sovereignty or give legitimacy to the Islamic Republic. It was a fairly thoughtful and multilateral a series of negotiations that led to that nuclear accord that really put some pretty severe limitations on Iran's nuclear program, and by extension of Iran's kind of domestic national defense posture. And by leaving from the JCPOA, Trump really empowered the critics of that deal inside Iran to not once again find themselves in positions where they could dictate the terms of play to more moderate elements, but to once again kind of rekindle this existential national identity that the Islamic Republic has been very expert at kind of using against its domestic opposition since 1979, for 40 years now. And so, you know, whatever positive outcome might have come out of those domestic battles in the aftermath of the nuclear deal inside Iran now have all vanished as well.
Yeah, and that's the incredibly counterintuitive nature of it, because if you want to get rid of the IRGC and the supreme leader and this terrible theocracy, or this kleptocratic theocracy that the people of Iran don't like, this is the last thing. Everything you're doing is playing into the hands of the radicals, not into the hands of the moderates. And that's just so unbelievably stupid. Again, I'm speaking with Hussein Banai, who's an Iranian-American scholar and professor of international studies at the Indiana University in Bloomington, where he teaches Iran's political development as well as U.S.-Iran relations. And his forthcoming book is Hidden Liberalism in Modern Iran. But what I find troubling is, as we have this president who's all over the map, he doesn't want a war with Iran, obviously, and he's making that clear, which then just in terms of being the great negotiator, the art of the deal, that's amazingly stupid. If you want to have leverage over Iran, you don't capitulate in the way that he is. And I'm not saying that as a hawk. I'm saying that as a dove. But what really troubles me is, because you have such an out-to-lunch president who doesn't know what he's doing, you got Bolton behind the scenes like a Rasputin, causing trouble, but he's been marginalized from what I understand. But Pompeo fills the vacuum. He's now running point on this whole disaster. And frankly, there's a very sick symbiosis between Pompeo and the supreme leader and his terrible son, Mujtaba, and also Ahmadinejad and all of those loonies, religious loonies on the Iranian leadership side, who, you know, send notes down the well to the hidden imam in the hope that they'll have this apocalyptic messiah show up. That kind of, you know, pornographic theology is identical to what Pompeo believes. Pompeo has made speeches invoking the rapture. And there's no difference between the Christian, you know, perverted a theology of their interpretation of the book of Revelation and the Iranian 12th obsession. So that's the symbiosis that I worry. In geopolitics, you have to have rational players. You can't have religious messianic views infecting your decision making.
That's right. And I think it's what's even I'm kind of laughing out of despair. But what is striking here is that apocalyptic vision that Iranian leaders have had since the revolution has really been tamed by the fact that at the end of the day, Iran really doesn't have much capabilities when it comes to its military or its role anywhere beyond outside of its borders, really. But in the case of the United States, you're talking about a major world power who could really inflict tremendous harm, not just through its military, but through its sanctions in ways that it could kind of push its allies to abandon any kind of positive diplomacy. And to really change the course of relations with traditional leaders of stability in world politics, international institutions, the role of diplomacy and diplomats, third parties that usually play a positive role, all of those things have been kind of sacrificed, and we're not even going to be able to see the damage for many years to come, because these relationships took many years to build. You know, you think of Sultan of Oman, for instance, who crucially helped those back-channel talks between Iranian negotiators and U.S. negotiators in the latter part of the Bush years that extended into the Obama presidency. You think of the Europeans who really stuck their neck out in ensuring that Iran really agreed to some fairly stringent limitations on its program in exchange for fairly lucrative economic deals. And then you think of, you have to think about the damage this will do in the long term to, you know, a new form of diplomacy that seemed to have finally figured out how to bring out an erstwhile rogue state into the community of nations and transition it into something resembling a kind of a well-behaved modern state. And those folks are now kind of on the chopping block, both inside of Iran and in the U.S., obviously, they have been culled as well. So in practical terms, these apocalyptic visions, if they don't come to fruition, the negative effects of them, I think we're going to feel for many decades to come.
But if you were in Iran, and if, even in the leadership, and the rational leadership, like President Rouhani, you still have to recognize that the United States has already declared economic warfare on you and that they're just squeezing you to the point where, you know, you've got to cry uncle. That's the strategy. At least that's the Pompeo strategy.
Right.
And they've cut off their oil customers. So that's the current reality. I don't understand, though, why, and I think it's largely because the Supreme Leader is, again, in a different world because he, you know, he thinks he's a god, or he's God's representative, I guess, you know, that if he was smart, he'd take a deal from Trump. It's just like Kim Jong-un. I mean, this guy, Trump is so desperate to look good. He doesn't care about geopolitics. He just wants to look good. And wants to win. So, you know, why wouldn't the Supreme Leader recognize what Trump is signaling, that he's willing to do anything just to look good? Just Kim Jong-un figured that out, too. And Xi Jinping has figured that out, too. And I'm sure Putin has, too. But do you think the Supreme Leader is going to figure this out?
Oh, no. I actually think that, you know, the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ali Khamenei, and that office that he represents temporally, you know, is very much dependent on people like Trump to renew its legitimacy. I think he absolutely looks at this moment of crisis with a great deal of favor, because what had happened after the nuclear deal was that Iran all of a sudden had basically opened its domestic economy to European businesses, which had embarrassingly demonstrated just a depth of corruption that the Islamic Republic was suffering under, and how asymmetrically these profits, new profits from these contracts, were being funneled into state coffers. And so there was a real domestic legitimacy issue. But by Trump coming in and pulling out of the deal, Ali Khamenei has been able to refocus the attention on this kind of ageless, perennial enemy, the United States, once again, and to reassert his control and the control that he has over the security services on the country once again. So, you know, in a way, the Islamic Republic has had its own Trump, you know, for the last 40 years, who are all of a sudden empowered by the current president of the United States. So I don't think they're looking at this, you know, as some sort of opportunity to be exploited, other than to just, you know, renew the enmity so that they could once again feel secure in their position domestically inside Iran.
So if there's a symbiosis between our hawks and their hawks, what's going to break the impasse?
I think the impasse is going to have to be in the shape of a kind of a change in strategy on the part of the United States. I think the Iranians are very comfortable being in this kind of beleaguered position. At the end of the day, they're still technically adhering to the terms of the agreement that they signed. The Europeans seem to be happy with them. They really don't pose a military threat. No matter how much we'd like to portray him that way, it's just materially, factually not the case, which is why Trump is so hesitant to kind of take the bait and attack them. I think the real impasse is this kind of farcical, comical situation we have inside the White House. You know, these dueling impulses that have brought this manufactured crisis to the precipice of military exchange. You know, Pompeo wanting to represent perhaps these, you know, apocalyptic visions, channeling perhaps Bibi Netanyahu's interests and the kind of hawks and pro-Israel hawks in U.S. foreign policy.
And MBS, by the way. You've got to add Mohammed bin Salman to this mix. And we know that Trump and Jared Kushner are making all kinds of business deals, real estate deals, when they leave office with the Saudis.
Absolutely.
So there's a lot of corruption going on there. So MBS maybe has some sway over Trump in terms of pushing him in a hawkish direction.
Absolutely. I mean, I think those two have been probably the most instrumental actors in terms of getting Trump to this position. I think much more so than Pompeo or Bolton, whom Trump, you know, ultimately regards as subordinates that really don't have much to offer. They're just there to carry his orders. Bin Salman and Netanyahu, on the other hand, actually do offer him a great deal of legitimacy in the case of Netanyahu. In the case of Bin Salman, you know, absolutely, these kind of lucrative business contracts long-term for he and his family businesses, but also a kind of a, you know, sovereign wealth fund that could be his bank going into the future. So I think those two have absolutely been key in pushing this policy in terms of Trump
sure.
himself.
Now MBS is back in the spotlight, being held culpable for the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. So it's a good time for MBS to want to change the subject and start a war, right?
Absolutely, and I mean, I think you know. Saudi Arabia has been itching with every, you know, small skirmish with the Houthis that are backed by Iran's Revolutionary Guards to kind of portray this existential battle with Iran as something that the United States has to take more seriously. Obviously, as we speak today, the United States Senate voted to block the sale of arms to Saudi Arabia. Once again, embarrassing the president in terms of his eagerness to please a foreign leader so brazenly. So there are opportunities there for Trump to kind of distance himself from Bin Salman a bit, but I doubt it. I think ultimately this, like any other manufactured crisis that Trump has brought about, will only end when he gets to kind of put lipstick on a pig and call it his own, you know, unique greatest deal, et cetera, and move on. And the Iranians, I think, are hoping for that kind of outcome, to just wait it out and hopefully, you know, by 2020, he'll be gone. But that's a very obviously risky gamble. You know, this style of leadership that Trump has brought about seemed to do wonders in terms of distracting the news media here. Even the kind of the opposition media takes the bait and they go with the headlines that he creates. And in that regard, you know, you're dealing with someone who is to the presidency what professional wrestling is to Greco-Roman wrestling, right? It's kind of WrestleMania every day.
Right.
And he comes in and he kind of just jumps up and down triumphantly and says outlandish things, and the crowds roar and everyone covers the roar. And he gets out of these, you know, just so demonstrably weak hands and misbegotten policies over and over again.
Well, Hussein Banai, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Hussein Banai, who's an Iranian-American scholar and professor of international studies at Indiana University in Bloomington, where he teaches Iran's political development as well as U.S.-Iran relations. And his forthcoming book is Hidden Liberalism in Modern Iran. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the feckless display of a lack of strategy on the part of Democrats following the farce of Hope Hicks's closed hearings, at which the White House lawyer prevented her from saying anything.
Burning, I see Jesus coming. Jesus comes to pave the way. sweet sensation. Do you believe in second chance? Do you believe in rapture?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mike Lux, the president of American Family Voices and a partner in Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House and is the author of The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. And his latest book is How to Democrat in the Age of Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lux.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be on again.
Well, thank you, Mike. And yesterday's hearings, closed hearings before the House Judiciary Committee, featuring the White House Communications Director Hope Hicks, who refused to answer questions, being prompted constantly by the White House lawyer sitting beside her, was a complete train wreck. Nothing came out of it. The Democrats looked sort of feckless that they had the hearings in the first place and got nothing out of it. At the very least, why wasn't this a public hearing? Then you would have got something out of it. You would have been able to, the public would have been able to see the nature of the White House's obstruction because, you know, every time she was asked a question, the White House lawyer would stop her from answering. That would have been useful television. But having a bunch of Democratic congressmen talking after the hearing in the corridor saying, well, we can't say what was said because it was a closed hearing, but it was not really good. I mean, God, talk about looking pathetic.
It was theater of the absurd. And I don't, for the life of me, I don't understand what they're doing. I think that Democrats are, they're trying to be moderate and careful and thoughtful, and they're up against this man and his minions who don't give a damn about, you know, about anything, about the law, about about good graces, about anything. And unless they toughen up, they are going to look feckless, and they do look feckless. And you're absolutely right. You know, you want to do a hearing where you don't answer questions? Fine. We're going to open it up, do it in front of the cameras, and we'll make you look like So I think they're handling this very weakly at the moment, and I have some thoughts about how they should handle it, but they're not being nearly aggressive enough.
Well, let's have your thoughts.
Well, I think the first thing they should do is they should start, they're holding people in contempt, which is good, but they should start fining people every day, $10,000 fine for anyone who is held in contempt of Congress. They have the legal authority to do that. There's precedent. It's been done before by other Congresses. And I just think they should start leveling fines. I also think they should put together either a select committee or even a House special prosecutor to drive investigations and go more aggressively in terms of these investigations. They need to not be passive. They need to not... I would not do any private hearings whatsoever. What's the point of doing a private hearing and then not having the person answer the question? It's ridiculous. So yeah, I think they absolutely need to toughen up, get far more aggressive, and go forward. I am for exploring impeachment hearings and going to that level because I think it will give us more, you know, legal tools and legal authority. But whether or not we do that, they could be far, far tougher than they're being right now.
And in terms of getting Don McGahn to testify, I mean, I find it difficult to believe that McGahn is not willing to testify, particularly after Trump trashed him in his ABC interview Stephanopoulos. I mean, there's clearly no love lost. You know, Trump is accusing McGahn of lying to Mueller. So if Trump can't have it both ways. He can't attack McGahn's testimony to Mueller and then refuse to let McGahn testify.
Well, that's exactly right. And I tell you what I would do with McGahn and what I would do with others. The target here is not the people we want to testify in these two examples we've been talking about. The point here is to gather information. So I would grant them immunity. And again, Congress has the power to do this. Congress has done this with other witnesses in the past multiple times. Grant them immunity, full immunity, and compel their testimony. They can go ahead and do that. And then they can have the House Sergeant at Arms arrest people if they don't testify under those conditions. Democrats can be so much more aggressive than they're being right now, and they're not even playing by Marcus of Queensbury rules, because Marcus of Queensbury rules means you can punch people. They aren't even doing that. they're playing by sit in the corner and let Trump punch you and not do anything in return. So I don't know what the hell you call those kinds of rules.
So given that we're sort of running out of time, really, on either impeaching or getting the Mueller report to a point where the public understands what's in it. I mean, it was so constipated and with impenetrable legalese that it's difficult reading for even aficionados of the law and of politics. And clearly what we need is, now that we have the book that nobody's reading, let's get to the movie, right? And that should be the strategy. So
yeah.
Where would you say we are in that strategy?
I will say this about the book. It's interesting, but I am aware of a series of focus groups where people were read passages from the book, and they understood them, and they were shocked by them. And it actually turned around a lot of attitudes. What's going on right now is that most folks are not following the national news because they think it's so petty and so ridiculous. Trump has made it all seem stupid, right? So, and they don't want to follow the day-to-day back and forth between Trump and whoever is saying bad things about Trump. So they're just literally not watching the news, not following the news. So they're barely aware that the Mueller report exists. A lot of them have never heard of Bob Mueller. I mean, seriously, this is like what focus groups are finding. But when you actually read to them, so here's the investigation by the special prosecutor, here's what he found that Trump did, and you read them sentences from the report, people are shocked by it and appalled, and it really makes a difference in how they view Trump. So I don't think that this is too much legalese. I think if we could get the information out to people, what was in that report, then I think it would actually make a big difference.
Well, what do we do? I mean, do we get Orson Welles? He's not available, but somebody to narrate them on. I know the radio host, Tom Hartman, has been reading from the report on a regular basis.
Yeah.
He's actually doing what you're suggesting. But how do you do that on a national scale that's going to reach these basically detached people who aren't interested in politics? And after all, the election's 18 months away. You can't blame them. How do you penetrate that?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One is, I do think that through social media, where friends are sending stuff to friends, I think through targeted digital advertising, where you're reaching out to opinion leaders, I think that you can move this message in some different ways. Get it to people who have influence over other people. And with our ability now to geo-target information, so if you know that there's a meeting of, you know, all the major civic organizations in town, and you geo-targeted their telephones for ads with information from the Mueller report, people would see it. And those are the kind of folks who spread the word and talk to people. So I think there are strategies for getting it out. You know, I think that the Democrats should be talking about it some. I mean, I am not for being obsessive about the Mueller report and repeating every line in it, but I do think it's appropriate and it's useful information to get some of this info out when you're doing Rotary Club, when your local congressperson is doing Rotary Club meetings, when you're doing civic associations, when you're going to church committee meetings and giving talks. And I think that candidates can do it, elected officials can do it, but also citizens can do it. So I actually think there are a lot of different ways for getting this information out to people.
So obviously the Democrats, a lot of Democrats are angry at Hillary Clinton for losing to Trump. It just seemed like, how could you lose to this guy? But if they lose in 2020, my fear is that it'll be the end of the Democratic Party, that the base will simply abandon them. So there's an awful lot at stake here. And at this point, we have a front runner in Joe Biden, who, for reasons I cannot understand, decided to talk about how he got along with these segregationists. And now it's given an opportunity.
By name. He picked out the two worst, nastiest, ugliest, most horrible people that he could have picked out. Yeah, that was pretty bizarre. Anyway,
But the point is that people, you got Cory Booker piling on. Of course, he's trying to get noticed because he's in the back of the field. At this point, with Democrats talking about reparations, which is a noble thing to do, no question about it. But my sense is that, for God's sake, get into power first. Don't blow it with the center in this country. It's the only way you're going to get elected is to win the center over so you can peel them away from Trump. And the progressive side that you work with, from my experience, they tend to want to feel good and feel good about their beliefs, and they'd rather be righteous than effective. I don't mean to be that critical, but I am. Whereas, I know from a fact that people who share my liberal beliefs are unelectable in this country. It's a basically conservative country. So I just, for the life of me, don't understand why they're talking about things like reparations. It just seems like they're on a suicide mission.
Well, so I want to push back a little bit on you, Ian. First of all, I don't think people are talking about reparations very much at all. I mean, it's mentioned every so often. Someone will ask a question at a forum, and a candidate will say something like, "Well, I think we should take a look at repairing some of the injustices that were done." I don't know, even of the candidates who say, "Yeah, we should take a look at it," I don't know that any of them have offered a specific plan. I don't know that any of them make it a part of their stump speech. There was a congressional hearing about it the other day here, which may be what you're responding to, but it was one congressional hearing out of scores of them that happen every week. I just don't think that many people are talking about it. I think that
it's one of those issues that people
are exploring a little bit.
Right, but the person who is talking about it is Mitch McConnell. He sees an opening there, and
of course, and look, I do agree with your basic point about not talking about things that are incredibly unpopular, and making them a big deal. And of course, Republicans are going to anytime anybody does say something, they're going to attack on it. But I also think, here's my other point. Republicans will attack no matter what, even if no one says reparations. Republicans will use the word, even if 23 of the 24 candidates running for office say they're not socialist. Mitch McConnell's going to call everybody a socialist on the Democratic side. So we can't worry about those attacks. They're going to come. They're going to happen. We have to build them into our plan. But we have to push back with our own compelling message and talk about what we want to talk about. And I do agree with you that we need to be talking about kitchen table economics. We need to be talking about issues that really matter to, a wide majority of American people. I will say one more thing, and that is I don't think the country is an essentially conservative country. I don't believe that. If you look at the polling on most major issues, not on everything for sure, and some of the social stuff that you're talking about, like reparations, you're definitely right. But on most economic issues and even most social issues, the country is actually pretty progressive. The danger is that we get caught up in some of these discussions over obscure issues that nobody has ever heard of and that nobody cares about. And the other danger is that they think that we represent elites and the status quo. If people think that the Democratic Party represents elites and the status quo, we will lose. So we have to have a message where we are very clear, very, very progressive, very populist, and that speaks to the everyday concerns of regular voters. And then I think we win whatever the Republican attacks are.
Well, but I think that the Republicans are framing the Democrats as the people that don't so much care about the elites, and they talk about the liberal elite, of course, but then basically saying, look, they only care about black and brown people, they don't care about you white people. And to my mind, if you go down the path of identity politics and the Democrats get labeled as being only interested in identity politics, and it's not that I don't think reparations should happen. I just think that you should get into power first and then make them happen. You know, you talk to the center, but you govern to the left. If you talk to the left and govern to the left, you're never going to get to govern to the left. That's my argument.
Well, I think you and I are close to the same place, but I think there are a lot of different ways of getting elected, and I talk about this on a video I just did. There are many different paths to building a 51% plus coalition, but I think they all have at their core that we talk about the economic issues that matter the most to a broad majority of the American people, that we don't get bogged down into issues that we can't win, and that we build broad consensus around a broad progressive economic agenda and social agenda, which is popular with people. And I do think that's how we win elections.
Well, Mark Lux, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Happy to do it, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Lux, who's the president of American Family Voices and a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House and is the author of The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. And his latest book is How to Democrat in the Age of Trump. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the need for the revival of the journalism of I.F. Stone.
You don't need to change.
He summoned all of his strength in a climb. It suffered all of his strength in the fall. Sometimes when he got into fighting, man, he could fight with you all day long. He was a good man, and now he's gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Peter Dreyer, who's the E.P. Clapp Distinguished Professor of Politics and the Chair of Urban Environmental Policy Department at Occidental College. His books include Place Matters, Metro Politics for the 21st Century, and the 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame. And he has an article, The Common Dreams, in praise of I.F. Izzy Stone. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Dreyer.
Thank you, Ian.
So, I used to talk to Izzy years ago, and obviously he was an extraordinary force in American journalism. And as you point out, he was an indefatigable researcher and an uncompromising critic of political oligarchy, crony capitalism, racism, and American militarism. Do we need him today?
This is exactly when we need him. The Trump corruption, the Trump crony capitalism, the entire way in which the media has, with some great exceptions, kind of given a platform to this neo-fascist president and not really pierced the veil of his policies. The media have been pretty good at pointing out Trump's lies about, you know, how big the parade was during his inauguration or whether or not he's building the wall. But the kind of stuff that I.F. Stone did in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s and 70s was to show the collusion, and he used that word, between big corporations and the government, about the military-industrial complex, you know, big things, things that change the course of history. And we really need reporters, investigative reporters today who will do some of that. You know, we do have some really good investigative reporters these days at ProPublica, at The Nation, at Mother Jones, at The Washington Post, at The New York Times. But I.F. Stone was a one-man band. He didn't need a big organization. So if you had, you know, 500 I.F. Stones at The New York Times, you know, you could imagine the kind of investigative reporting that would go on. So what was remarkable about Stone was that he ran his newsletter called I.F. Stone's Weekly, which he published himself out of his house for about 20 years in the 50s and 60s and early 70s. He did it on his own. And by going through carefully researching records, public records, congressional testimony, he was a incredible reader of the congressional record. I mean, the kind of level of detail that you know, requires enormous patience. And of course, he did it without the internet, you know, without newspaper archives. He did it without, you know, the kind of sort of quick access to information that we have now. And so there's really nobody like I.F. Stone in the mainstream media. And he was himself in the mainstream media for many years, and he eventually quit to start his own weekly newsletter. And it was incredibly influential. He only had about 70,000 subscribers, but his influence is much greater than that.
Well, what he did in the I.F. Stone's Weekly, which began in 1953 and continued through to 1971, was, we mentioned earlier, he was an incredible researcher, and he would pore over the congressional record and other government documents looking for the fine print. And the great value was that the mainstream press were able to pick up on what he was pointing out. So, you know, a big part of the job of journalism is really tedious work. And mm-hmm. most people don't yeah. want to do it. They want to be TV stars and get these big, right. you know, speaking fees and be pundits. So it's the sort of unglamorous side of journalism, if you will.
Yeah, he was a muckraker in the tradition of Upton Sinclair and Lincoln Steffens and folks like that. And probably his biggest coup as a journalist was in 1964. He was the only American journalist who challenged President Johnson's account of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which was the excuse that Johnson used to declare war in Vietnam. And he used it entirely, Stone entirely used public records, a close reading of public documents, to able to uncover that Johnson was lying about why we got into Vietnam. And today, as Trump and his allies are trying to get us into a war with Iran, it looks like, you know, we could use I.F. Stone again to try to basically tell the truth. And he was a radical, no doubt about it, but he was an objective reporter, meaning he ferreted out the truth. And he had a point of view, and he wasn't reluctant to say what that was. But he was very careful in all of his writings, particularly in his own weekly, to make sure that the readers were able to confirm the information they were getting by providing them with the sources of information that he used. And he occasionally used background sources, you know, inside sources to get scoops and so forth, but he mainly relied on public records. One of his other great scoops was to expose how the Atomic Energy Commission, which is responsible for overseeing nuclear weapons and nuclear testing, how they lied about the testing that was going on in the 1950s. And he caught them red-handed, and they eventually had to apologize for lying to the American public. And so, you know, he was a one-man band, but he, you know, did the work of dozens of reporters in terms of how influential he was. And, you know, he died in 1989, and there's really nobody that's replaced him. You know, to me, the closest thing might be Michael Moore, you know, who's a filmmaker, not a journalist, but who uses another medium to expose the kind of corruption and crony capitalism of big corporations and their collusion with right-wing business and government officials.
So one of the things that I most admired about Izzy Stone was that a lot of liberals sort of caved during the McCarthy period. And, you know, it was pretty horrible what McCarthy was doing. And that was clearly a moment in American history where the liberals were pushed into a retreat because the right wing and McCarthy and Hoover and Roy Cohn and all these dreadful people were equating anybody that was progressive on domestic politics with aiding and abetting the foreign enemy, the Soviet Union. But he stood firm, and even though he was attacked, he said, as you point out in your article, "I may be just a red Jew SOB to them, but I'm keeping Thomas Jefferson alive." And of course, in 1992, the right-wing magazine Human Events tried to make the case that he was a Soviet spy. And of course, there's nothing in FBI files that would suggest that. So that to me is an important lesson in not allowing the right wing to filibuster and buffalo you into retreat, which is really the tactic on the right. That's what they do. They move the goalposts to the right by calling everybody liberal. And and he was the one guy that said, screw you. You know, there's nothing wrong with being liberal.
Yeah, I think of I.F. Stone as kind of the Pete Seeger of journalism. You know, he was, you know, a man of incredible principle. They tried to silence Pete Seeger. They tried during the McCarthy era. He was, like I.F. Stone, he was brought before the investigating committees and asked about his affiliations, and he refused to say, you know, and he outlasted them. You know, Pete Seeger used to say, "I outlasted all the bastards that attacked me," and the same thing happened to I.F. Stone. But we're seeing a repeat of this now. I had an article in The Nation about 2 weeks ago about how Trump is branding any Democrat from Joe Biden to Bernie Sanders as a socialist. He said it again at his rally in Orlando yesterday. He said it in his State of the Union speech that the Democratic Party is a socialist party, that we have to root out socialists in America. And then, of course, what he means by socialism is he tries to conflate it with Venezuela. So he's, you know, he's using the same kind of McCarthyite tactics. And the mainstream media have once again kind of allowed him to say that without challenging the fact that he's lying about that. I mean, if Joe Biden is a socialist, then I must be a candy bar. I mean, it's just, you know, it's ridiculous. And but Stone, like you said, he refused to roll over. He had principles. He said, "I'm not going to allow the McCarthyites to silence me." And when he was during the McCarthy era, when he was basically unemployable, when no mainstream newspaper, even the liberal New York Post, when that no mainstream newspaper would hire I.F. Stone, he said, "Okay, I'm gonna do it on my own. I'm gonna start my own newspaper." And that's when he started I.F. Stone's Weekly. And very similarly, when the McCarthyites got to the Weavers and Pete Seeger, the singing group that he sang with, Pete Seeger said, "Okay, well, I'm going to make it on my own," and he did. He started his own, you know, he did have his own career as a solo artist, singing folk songs to progressive groups. You know, one of the things about I.F. Stone's Weekly is that some of the subscribers, like, were like Eleanor Roosevelt and Albert Einstein. I mean, people who had influence, and like you said earlier, the mainstream newspaper reporters and editors, they read his newsletter very carefully because they got, you know, tidbits for stories that they would sometimes use and not give him credit for. And so when he exposed the Gulf of Tonkin fiasco and the lie of LBJ, later mainstream reporters picked up on that, but Stone never got the credit he deserved for uncovering that incredible scandal.
Well, I saw you mentioned how Trump wants to equate the Democrats with socialism in Venezuela. Of course, the great irony is that we're learning from Bloomberg News that Trump is now lost interest in regime change in Venezuela because he got bored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable. But at his rally, you alluded to Peter Dreyer in Orlando announcing his 2020 re-election run. It was worse than that in many ways. It wasn't. Not only did he label Democrats as socialists, but he also said that they were unpatriotic and that they hate America. And I don't understand why they should put up with that. why allow this horrible person to frame you in that way?
Well, it's one thing for the Democrats to say, you know, you're lying. We're not socialists. And, you know, some of them are. I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders says he's a socialist, and Ocasio-Cortez says she's a socialist, and DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, are growing membership and so forth. But, you know, most politicians, most even liberal and progressive Democrats, including Elizabeth Warren, don't call themselves socialists. This is a tried-and-true practice by the right to, you know, to basically defame people, try to divert attention away from their own reactionary ideas by labeling other people socialists. But the real question that I have Stone would raise, and that you've raised, is why does the media allow Trump to do that? I mean, in some ways, the mainstream media have become kind of a transmission belt for whatever Trump says. And, you know, he is the president of the United States, so you have to, when he, you know, when he says something, you're supposed to report it. But, and some of the media have started these columnists that keep track of his lies. Apparently, according to CNN, in his 76-minute speech in Orlando yesterday, he told 15 lies, and they probably missed a few. But that shows that Trump was, you know, probably exercising some restraint, because, you know, 15 lies in an hour and 15 minutes is probably not many for Trump. But they just give him a platform. And, you know, I it might be weird to ask the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times to not report on the president. But, you know, they can report on what he says, but then they have to point out that, you know, most of what he says is BS. And that's what I.F. Stone was so brilliant at. He pointed out the BS, and he didn't do it in a kind of flamboyant way. He just said, you know, President Johnson said, here's why we are going into Vietnam, because of this Gulf of Tonkin episode, an alleged attack on an American ship. And it's not true. And you have to do that on a daily basis. You have to basically immunize the American people from believing what this liar in the White House is doing. And if we had more people like I.F. Stone in mainstream journalism today, I think the American people would be much better informed about not just the petty stuff that Trump gets accused of, but the important stuff, including the preparation that he's now trying to persuade the American people, the preparation to go to war in the Middle East.
Well, you started out talking about Trump's fascist tendencies, shall we say. And the one thing about fascists is, both in terms of Mussolini and in particular Hitler, was that it was a compact between far-right politics and criminality. They were criminals. And that looks like what Trump really is. And that is, I mean, he's running around talking about the Democrats being unpatriotic and hating America. This is an act of a desperate criminal who's trying to shift attention away from his own crime to other. And one can only hope that eventually he's one step ahead of the sheriff. And with the Democrats being so feckless, he's maintaining that situation. But at some point or other, I hope the truth catches up on him. And I thank you for joining us. Very much appreciate it, Peter Dreyer.
Sure, Ian. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Dreyer, who's the E.P. Clapp Distinguished Professor of Politics and Chair of the Urban and Environmental Policy Department at Occidental College. His books include Place Matters, Metro Politics for the 21st Century, and The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame. And he has an article at Common Dreams in praise of I.F. Izzy Stone. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loves.